I want to begin this lesson this evening in Matthew chapter 6, a very familiar passage to us there. And Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount admonishes us about what is important. Matthew chapter 6, and beginning in verse 27. Matthew 6 and verse 27. And which of you by being anxious can add a single cubit to his lifespan? And why are you anxious about clothing? Observe how the lilies of the field grow. They do not toil, nor do they spin. Yet I say to you that even Solomon in all of his glory did not clothe himself like one of these. But if God so arrays the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the furnace, will he not much more do so for you, O men of little faith? Do not be anxious then, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or with what shall we clothe ourselves? For all these things the Gentiles eagerly seek, for your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. Therefore do not be anxious for tomorrow will care for itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. And as is usual, of course, with the words of Jesus, every sentence and every thought is packed with meaning and application for us. I want to just take out of here this one idea and expand on it a little bit, this idea of why are you concerned about clothing? And do not say, what shall we wear? Of course, the implication here is that we shouldn't worry about whether we will have clothes at all to wear or not, but we ask ourselves that question in a lot of different ways. Every morning, I suppose, most of us will stand and look in our closet or pull out our drawers or look at the pile in the corner and say, what shall I wear today? And that becomes, some ways, a repeated ritual with fraught with all sorts of difficulties for us. What will I wear today? And what will that say about me? And what kind of impression will I create? It's been said that there are only three reasons to wear a coat and a tie. One is because the weather requires it, which is not often the case in Florida. Two, everybody else is wearing one. Or three, to show everybody that you have one. And that is fraught with all kinds of meaning, too, about showing people whether you have one of those or not. Mark Twain, of course, was a great opponent of formalism, and especially formalism in dress. And he once visited Harriet Beecher Stowe without a tie on. And when he returned, his wife reprimanded him that he had gone to visit that lady without a tie. And so he sent his servant around with a note and his tie saying, I was there this morning for about 30 minutes without a tie. And so now I'm sending my tie. Take it out and look at it for 30 minutes. And if you will, please return it because it's the only one that I own. I think I would have liked Mark Twain at least on some levels, although on plenty of other levels I think he and I would have had difficulty getting along. I have, of course, had some difficulty wearing ties on occasion where people thought that I should wear ties, not as much as some other people have had, but it is an interesting matter about whether and when and what circumstances you wear a tie and what it says about you or what it statement it makes about your feelings about the occasion that you're going to as to whether you wear a tie or not. And there's much concern, obviously, about clothing in the world today. Brand names count almost as much as looks when people go to choosing the kind of clothes that they're going to wear. My sociology class, we often have a session on status symbols, and I ask them, and then I very quickly forget, you know, what are the brand names that you look for, and what are the little symbols on people's clothes that really are in this year? And, of course, over the years, those have changed, and that which once was in is no longer in, and it's really difficult sometimes to keep up with that. What was once stylish may not be stylish today, but it may be stylish once again. At some time in the future, perhaps. At least that's the hope that I have. As the number of ties in my closet continues to expand and expand, one of these days I'll be able to use those again. And of course, you know, we have all sorts of humorous stereotypes about clothing. The woman who looks in her closet, packed row after row of clothes up on the ceiling, shoes all over the place, and says, I have nothing to wear. And that's not even funny, I guess, to most of you. Or there is the proverb in the land of the man who has been on a diet, and now he has two sets of clothes, one for his small size and one for his large size, and he's pretty soon going to be back into his large size. And we have unfortunately seen that yo-yo effect maybe up too close and personal in our own lives. And despite these kind of semi-humorous ideas about clothing, recognize too that clothing is a deep philosophical issue. It's one of those kind of taken for granted aspects of life, which really are significant, really significant in saying who we are. For instance, one of the frequently asked philosophical questions: what's the difference between men and animals? What are the differences? Well, from a Bible believing point of view, we know the essential difference, that is that we're created in God's image and we have a soul. Philosophers not ever quite so ready to take the Bible account for that face value, but they will give often many answers about that, the ability to reason or the use of language or humor. But one of the frequently given responses to that question, what are the differences between men and animals, is the issue of clothing. And there is a considerable difference here. We think it's kind of amusing when we go out for a walk in the park and here's somebody walking their dog with a sweater on. It's always strange to me to see clothes on animals. And in fact, one of the great scenes in the circus is always to get the little dog with a little tutu on and out dancing up on its two hind legs in imitation, perhaps, of some human being. But we're not surprised. In fact, we're glad to see people with clothes on. We would be mortified to see people without clothes on out walking around. God has made man so that he needs clothes. Animals do not need clothes. Men need clothes, and they wear clothes. And therein lies all those issues of pride and shame and status and discrimination. It is amazing how important clothing is to us and how frequently it is part of our thought process and our estimation of others. Joseph's cloak, for instance, showed his father's favoritism for him and provoked his brother's jealousy. Often it is our clothes that identify us. A little boy said to his friend, "We got a new baby at our house." And his friend said, "Is it a boy or a girl?" And he says, "I don't know. They haven't put any clothes on it yet." Well, we know when we start putting clothes on, we know whether it's a boy or a girl. And then as people get older and the kind of clothes they wear tell us about whether they are a white-collar worker or a blue-collar worker, or whether they are just a laborer of some sort. Clothes tell us a lot. We ought to be careful, of course, about our judging of other people based on their clothes. James chapter 2. And verses 2 through 4 in the church there, James has quite a bit to say about the status differences. In James chapter 2 and verse 2, he says, "For if there comes into your assembly a man with a gold ring in goodly apparel, and there come in also a poor man in vile raiment, and you have respect to him that wears the gay clothing, and say to him, 'Sit here in a good place,' and say to the poor, 'Stand there,' or 'Sit here under my footstool,' are you not then partial in yourselves, and are you become judges of evil thoughts?" We ought to be careful about how we judge people based on their clothes, and we all recognize that that's a danger in some ways, that we fall into judging people inappropriately on the basis of clothes. As Shakespeare said in Macbeth, "Scattered clothes make small vices appear. Robes and furred gowns hide them all." That we are very frequently willing, when a person is well-dressed, to give them the benefit of the doubt. When they're poorly dressed, however, we're suspicious oftentimes of their motives. And, you know, there is some sense, I guess, in the fact that the person dresses in a certain way, presents themselves in a certain way, that they are trying to make a statement. My dad always used to say, man's shoes may have holes in them, but he can always keep them polished. And I was thinking about that, so I polished my shoes. You know, notice they were unpolished this morning, but I polished them tonight because I was going to use that. But I think that really probably says something, at least in my dad's day, that a person had some concern about how they presented themselves, and they were not concerned so much about having rich raiment as the fact that a man would have some neatness in his appearance. He would take care of the little details, like his shoes being polished. We should be careful, I guess, about how we show ourselves to other people. My nephew went through a phase. Finally, he joined the Army, and they straightened out of his dressing issues, I guess. But he went through a phase where he wore those huge, three times too big pants, you know, that hang off the back of your underwear, and tattered shirts that he had gotten from the Salvation Army, and body art. And then he would complain when the police would stop him and be suspicious of him, or when he would go into a store and they would watch him while the time he was in the store. And I said, what in the world do you expect? That's exactly what you wanted to happen. That's why you dress that way. Now, don't complain about it. We should be careful about how we present ourselves to other people. And there are a lot of things in the Bible about clothes and how they fit in with the whole human condition, beginning, of course, with the story of Adam's first clothes in Genesis chapter 3, verses 7 through 17 there. We read about the nakedness of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. And before there was sin, they were naked and were not ashamed. But after they sinned, they knew that they were naked and they were ashamed. And they made for themselves garments out of fig leaves. And then when God came into the garden to walk with Adam, as was his custom apparently, Adam hid himself from God because he knew of his sin and knew of his shame and knew of his nakedness. And so he explains to God that he was naked. And God said, how did you know that you're naked? Who told you that? It seems somehow tied up with the whole issue of sin that we know about nakedness, that we know about the shame of sin. We know the shame of nakedness in some ways. And God made them clothes again out of animal skins. And of course, there are people who make a great issue out of the fact that they had made for themselves clothes and that somehow maybe God didn't think those were adequate and he made other clothes for them, making an argument on the basis of the etymology of the words that the first clothes they made for themselves were really from the word for belt or for apron, and that when God made garments for them, he made them so that the word has the meaning of a cloak or a coat. And they will make an argument somehow that they know based on that how much has to be covered in order for us to be modestly appareled. And I'm not always really moved by those kinds of arguments I on two levels. One is I suspect that the etymology of words doesn't always provide us with the true meaning or the implication of those words, because I know that's the case in English, and every schoolboy knows that's the case in English, because every schoolboy will make the argument to you that nice means cross-eyed, that nice means lazy. And the Middle English word nice, yes, it means strange, lazy, cross-eyed, but it comes from the Latin. Nice comes from the same origin as the word science, which means to know, except this has the negative in front of the N, so it means not to know. So that's why it means strange or lazy or not knowing in some way. And then it came to mean, from that, it came to mean somebody who was difficult to please, who was fastidious. They were nice in their feelings about things. And then, of course, it came to mean somebody who had high standards. And then it comes to mean, of course, today, finally, a general term of approval. She's just nice. And the etymology of it doesn't tell us anything at all about what it means. And I'm not too moved by the arguments that people will make on the basis of Adam's clothes about what our own clothes should be like, because I'm not sure that's the important point of the story. Else, if it were, maybe it means that God wasn't approving of their vegetation-made clothes, that he wanted them to wear clothes made out of fur, which would get us in a lot of trouble in this day and age, probably. I think there are occasions, of course, when our clothes are not appropriate. And we need to be careful as Christians to always present ourselves in the right way and make sure that we are making the right kind of statement to people by the clothes that we wear. And in fact, there are stories in the New Testament, too, about clothes, especially about Jesus' clothes. We are touched, of course, by the fact that he was wrapped, first of all, in those swaddling clothes and laid in the manger. We're touched, too, by the story in Mark chapter 5 about Jesus' garment when the woman who had an issue of blood touched his garment and felt the power go out of him, said, "Who has touched me?" And she has to acknowledge that she has touched him and been healed by the mere fact of touching his clothes. We have to recognize, too, the significance that Jesus Jesus intends when he is at that Last Supper with his disciples, and he lays aside the outer garment that he was wearing and girds himself up like a slave and washes their feet. And of course, who can think about clothes in the Bible without thinking about Jesus' robe that he was wearing when they arrested him and they tried him and they crucified him? And then, as the passage said in John chapter 19, they said among themselves, "Let us not tear it, but cast lots for it, so that it shall be that the scripture might be fulfilled, which says they divided not his garments, they divided his garments among them, and my clothing you cast lots for." There is some very poignant meaning to the fact that here Jesus has been stripped, humiliated, tortured, being put to death, and the hardened soldiers are gambling over his cloak. And there's too in the Old and the New Testament story in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 13, Paul's cloak. And you cannot read the story of Paul in prison and knowing that his end has come, and saying then in 2 Timothy 4 and verse 14 to Timothy, "The cloak that I left at Troas with Carpus, when there come, bring it with thee." And you wonder how much that this man Paul had spent for the service of the Lord and for the service of those churches and those Christians that he had been involved in teaching, that here he is reduced to saying, you know, "I had the one cloak, go and get that one cloak and bring it to me." And that makes you think once again, you know, about what do you mean when you go to your closet and you look and you say, "I got nothing to wear," because I suspect probably most of us got plenty to wear when we go to our closets. But we ask that question, and I think it's a good reason to ask that question. What do we wear and what should we wear? And there are two warnings, I think, in Scripture about our dress. 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 9. The Apostle Paul wants Timothy to understand and to be able to teach about clothing. And in the context in which in 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 8, he talks to the men. In verse 9, he talks to the women about their clothing. 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 8, "Therefore I want the men in every place to pray, lifting up holy hands without wrath and dissension." Likewise, and that suggests something similar to the idea that he has about men being praying and lifting up holy hands and not being filled with wrath and dissension. "Likewise, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing, modestly and discreetly, not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly raiment, but rather by means of good works, as befits women making a claim to godliness." And I think probably the general principles that he addresses here to women can be applicable to men as well, about the dress with which we adorn ourselves. And the first warning that he has here is that it ought to be modest, that it ought to be orderly, that it ought to be according to good taste. It ought not to draw excessive attention to oneself. The idea of shamefacedness, which is used in the old King James Version, means that you have still the ability to blush, that you know there's some lines that ought not to be crossed, that there are just some things that are not right. The word sobriety means with good judgment, with moderation. Propriety, that is, that it is fitting for the circumstances, that it is fitting for the person. And I think that therein lies some judgment issues for us. Everybody would recognize, I think, that that's the case. I'm pretty sure that our taste, that your taste, that your standards of dress have changed over the years. And I wouldn't hesitate to say probably that we live in a day and age in which probably we have witnessed people's dress become pretty close to the level of shameful. And as a result of that, even though we are dressed much more modestly than the society around about us, we maybe have slipped too far over the line of what is immodest and what is inappropriate. Proverbs chapter 7 and verse 10 is one of the places which talks about in the Bible about the attire of a harlot. And the Bible seems to recognize that there's a difference between the dress of those women who are godly and those women who are, you know, it's the very opposite of godly, those women who are wanton, those women who are in the professional business, those women who are harlots. And I thought about that for a while today, and I guess maybe I haven't been down on Nebraska Avenue the wrong places in a while. Decided I probably shouldn't go and do any research, but it seems to me probably pretty hard today to recognize the attire of a harlot, that the attire of a lot of women who wouldn't want to be identified as professional women sure looks a whole lot like the attire of a harlot, at least as it was portrayed in the movies just a generation ago. And I suspect that probably had the wise man Solomon been able to shift himself forward in time and observe the dress of just a lot of probably really pretty decent women today, he would have thought, and he saw them without knowing anything else, he would have thought, aha, that's the attire of the harlot, son, you need to avoid. There is this sense in which dress ought to be modest. It ought to be with shamefacedness. It ought to be in some way to express the difference between those who are godly and those who are wanton. And dress tells a lot about us. And surely we ought not to, like my nephew, be surprised if we dress in one way and send a message that people assume that that's the message that's true about us. The Bible also suggests another warning about dress, and that is the word. Let me say this about the immodest apparel. In some ways, I think probably a lot of women are influenced, as we all are, by the standards of the society around about us, and want to dress in such a way as they think will make them, propriety, I guess they would think, but stylish, probably, they would think. They don't want to stand out in some ways. They want to be a part of the culture. And I think a lot of women really don't understand how men feel and think. And so they underestimate the influence of their dress. A lot of times, of course, women would like to deliberately underestimate the influence of their dress or deny it so that they're free to have the influence on men that they're having and deny that they are culpable in any way. But I think there are probably a lot of women, especially young women, who don't have any idea, really, of what male mentality is and who dress in a way that's inappropriate without perhaps recognizing that that's the case. And there is a fault here, not just with the young girls, but there's a fault with their fathers, because their fathers ought to have told them, and their fathers ought to have made sure that they got the message across. And I would say probably they've tried, and girls ought to hear their fathers when they say, "You're not wearing that out of this house," because fathers understand more about the implication of that dress sometimes than their mothers do, and certainly sometimes more than those young girls do. Just dressing modestly, of course, is not ultimate protection from the praying men of our society, but it does go a long way, I think. And it is appropriate for Christian women to be concerned about the way in which they dress, and to dress in such a way as not to inflame the hearts and the minds of the men that they come in contact with in our society. Second warning in Scripture in this passage is a warning against too elaborate dress. In fact, that really seems to be the primary implication of the passage when he says that he wants them to dress modestly and discreetly. He goes ahead and gives some examples of what not to do. Not, he says, with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly garments, but rather by means of good works. And again, I think Christian dress does not partake of the worldly desire for attention or the distinction of putting other people down. And apparently that is something that was a part, unfortunately, of the New Testament church. It seems to be a concern that James has when he writes about the church there in Jerusalem. When some people come in and they have this costly raiment on, and suddenly they are thought to be somebody special and are treated in some special way, and somebody else comes in poor clothing and they are shunted aside, there becomes then the idea that I should dress in such a way that I will be one of the ones respected. And maybe even the idea enters in, I will dress in such a way that I can feel like I'm better than this other person. We are not always as well-dressed as we think we are. And we ought never to enter into this kind of competition with other people or measuring other people by the standards of their dress, by how costly it is or by how elaborate it is. And, you know, it seems to be that in the first century, apparently among the wealthy women, there was this competition of who could pile their hair the highest and who could put the most gold and most ornate jewels in it so that somehow they would put the other women down by their elaborate dress. And that, too, is wrong, just as wrong as dressing immodestly in the sense that we use the word. You know, there is the sense, too, with men somehow that they are able to distinguish themselves from others, to set themselves above others, or to put others down by the way in which they dress. That was something that was true even among the religious people, among the Jews. In Luke chapter 20, in verse 46, Jesus warns them about that kind of a man who would dress in such a way as to put others down. Luke 20 and verse 46, "Beware of the scribes who desire to walk in long robes and love greetings in the markets and the highest seats in the synagogues and the chief rooms at feast." And, of course, in Matthew 23 and verse 5, he warned about those that made broad their phylacteries and enlarged the borders of their garments. That's contrary entirely to the spirit of Christ, that we should try and put someone else down in whatever way, including with their dress. And I think there's one final point that I would want to make about the idea of dress, and that is that we are never quite so well dressed as we think that we are. Wearing nice clothes, of course, for most people makes us feel better about ourselves. I mean, we may think that we're smart or sophisticated or rich or impressive. You know, the very idea of going out and buying a new dress because it makes you feel better, or getting a new suit because it will help you to get a job, or because it will impress people. No matter how clever we feel about our dress, in God's presence, we ought to always be aware that we are poorly clothed. Isaiah 64 and verse 6 makes the point in dramatic fashion. Isaiah 64 and verse 6, "We are all like an unclean thing, and all our righteousnesses are like filthy rags. We all fade as a leaf, and our iniquities like the wind have taken us away." That regardless of how clever we feel because of our dress, or because of anything else for that matter, we are still sinners in the sight of God. And the only way really to be clean, the only way to be appropriately dressed, strangely enough, to wash ourselves in the blood of Christ. Revelation chapter 7, verse 14, "When he saw those who were being ushered in, he asked who they were and were told, 'These are they which come out of great tribulation and washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb.'" We ought to be careful that we are dressed appropriately, not with the clothes of the world. And we ought to be careful, of course, how we dress, so we give the right kind of impression about ourselves. But we ought to be careful that we are clothed with the good works that befits those who are Christians, whether man or woman. We ought to be careful that we have washed ourselves in the blood of the Lamb, and that we keep ourselves then clean. In Revelation chapter 3 and verse 4, "There are few, even in Sardis," he says, "which have not defiled their garments, and they shall walk with me because they are worthy." The real issue isn't what kind of clothes we wear. The real issue is whether we are in a right relationship with God through the blood of Jesus Christ. The real issue is whether we are clean in our heart and in our outward life. And, of course, all of that will have some implications, I think, about the kind of clothes that we wear And I could have spent some time talking about, you know, wearing clothes that are appropriate when we attend the worship services, the kind of clothing that we ought to wear in Ephesians chapter 6, the armor of the Lord. But our time has gotten away from us. And I would only leave you with this one thought, that we are, regardless of our appearance, regardless of our clothing, we are all of us standing before God in need of His mercy and of His grace. And we ought to be careful about judging too much one another on the basis of superficial things like clothes. We ought to be careful, certainly, about thinking too much of ourselves based on those superficial issues of what kind of clothes we may have, or what kind of education we may have, or what kind of job we may have, or how much money we may have. The really one only important thing is that we're in right relationship with God through Jesus Christ. And if that's not the case with you this evening, then that's the urgent issue of your life, and you ought to settle that this very evening if you can. And if you know what you ought to do to make yourself right this evening, we'd encourage you to do that as we stand and sing this song.